The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 642 for Sunday, January 29th, 2017. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where the goal is for you and us, all of us, each, to learn at least four new things. How do we do that? Well, we answer your questions, we share your tips, we share cool stuff found. That's how we get to the goal. And most often it works. So it's not really a goal, it's just a system. We get together each week and that's what we do. And we build all the stuff so that it works. The sponsor for this episode is Blue Apron, where you can go to blueapron.com/MGG and get your first three meals for free, shipped for free to you. Awesome stuff. I can't wait to tell you a little bit more about it. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How goes it, Mr. John F. Braun?
Yeah, it's gone.
It comes and it goes, kind of like
waxes and wanes.
It waxes and wanes. Well, hopefully it does so poetically, my friend. I stumbled onto a tip this week that I want to share with you. Have you ever gone to a website? If you use Safari to manage your passwords with iCloud Keychain or even just with Safari there, but also with iCloud Keychain, do you ever go to a website where you have multiple logins? I noticed it at PayPal this week because, you know, I've got a personal PayPal account. Then we've got PayPal accounts for, you know, Mac Observer and Backbeat Media and even Mac Geek Gab, because I was migrating all of your premium subscriptions over, which, by the way, MacGeekGab.com/premium will show you how to sign up and all of that stuff. But we're slowly migrating those subscriptions over. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. For those of you that are renewing soon, you've probably gotten emails from me about all that. But anyway, I needed to log in and it kept defaulting to my Backbeat Media account. And of course, PayPal logs you out after 15 minutes of inactivity. So I would be doing like a little bit of programming, working with Adam, massaging something. Then it was like, all right, let's log into PayPal. Let's see what it says. Crap. Okay. I'm logged out and Safari's defaulting me back to my Backbeat Media account. And it was driving me crazy. So I started looking at why is it defaulting me to my Backbeat Media account, even though every time I'm choosing the Mac Geek Gab one. And I noticed, I looked in Keychain access. The first place I looked was Safari passwords. They're all there, but there's nothing in there to me that indicated which one was the default and which one wasn't. But in looking in Keychain access, I have two keychains that contain PayPal passwords. One, of course, is my login keychain, and then the other is my iCloud keychain. And these passwords all seem to exist in both. I don't know if that's because I used all these types of things before we had iCloud keychain, but in the ones for backbeatmedia.com, in the comments, and this is where it gets weird, but just in the comments section is the word default. Guess what? Removing default, lowercase, from comments on my Backbeat Media PayPal logins, and I did it on both because it was on both the one in the login keychain and also the one in iCloud, and moving the word default or putting the word default in to the Mac Geek Gab one, guess what? That's all it takes. That's what it looks at. So literally the word default in the comments section in Keychain Access for your web form password is how it decides which one to pull up by default. And actually, I had several that were listed as default, so I don't know how it was deciding which one to do first, but it certainly was deciding, and I pulled the word default out of everything and only put it in the ones for the Mac Geek Gab account. And now that's what comes up by default. Pretty interesting, huh, John?
Huh. That's a nice little hack.
Well, yeah, it's a hack. That's exactly what it is. Not on our side, but a hack on Apple's side to, yeah, just throw the word default into the comments section there. And it's obviously a user editable field. So very strange, but that's that. I thought maybe, when I first saw it there, I thought, no, there's no way that they're actually parsing on this. They've just put this here so that we as the user know that it's what it said is the default. There's got to be a hidden field, but I figured I'd try it anyway. And that's sort of the best lesson I could ever teach anybody is just try it anyway, especially if you've got a backup. What's the harm? So it worked. Perfect stuff. I loved it. That's how it works. Fun, huh, John?
Yeah, if you're using that sort of thing.
I use both. I use 1Password, but I also use iCloud Keychain, and they kind of work fine in parallel with each other. If I change something, if I change a password, they both sort of notice and ask me if I want to save it. And the nice part is, yes, if I need to look for a password, much easier to look for it in 1Password. But if I'm on iOS, having it in iCloud Keychain, which is just there by default, way easier than having to use 1Password or any third party thing, because it's just baked right in and it's right there. So I use both. It doesn't, they, like I said, they work great in parallel, in fact. So there you go. That's my first tip for the day. Are we ready to move on?
Excellent.
All right.
Sure.
Scott had a question. Scott said, my wife and I are both set up with individual iCloud accounts, and we have done the iCloud family share option too, so we can share calendars and app purchases and all of that. What I'd like to be able to do, he says, is compile a grocery shopping list that we can add, edit, delete on both our iPhones, but my wife can see when she's out shopping because she seems to be the one that does that. I had a look under the Notes app, but I can't see a way to share my notes with her. I'm using a Mac with El Capitan because Apple won't let me upgrade to Sierra, and she's using an iPhone, so the app needs to work cross-platform too. Any suggestions? So we are living in that world here, and we use something called Our Groceries. Now, Our Groceries, I'm trying to think if that works. I think, it totally works on the web. Yeah. So what you do is, it's a free app. Your wife, in your case, your wife would have downloaded it onto her iPhone, but if you had an iPhone, you could download it there too. And when you start using it, and there's a list there, but you can assign an email address to your lists, and you can assign the same email address to all of your lists. And that's really kind of the key. And of course, when you add the email address to it, it says, all right, well, I got to send an email to that address and confirm that I can let you in. And then it does. And when you sign in on the web, it actually, you create a password. And you can see your lists on the web as well. So Our Groceries, it works really well. It's totally built for exactly what you're talking about here, having one list that everybody shares. And we actually started using it only recently because it has great integration. It has there's an Alexa skill for it, right? So we can say, and I'm not going to say the word, but we can say, trigger, tell Our Groceries to add, ice cream to the list. We use that one a lot. And sure enough, it adds it to the list. And the nice part is that list is with whomever needs it, whenever. So, it used to be, and here my wife is often the one that does the shopping, and it was not rare for her to, either call or text us and say, hey, can somebody take a picture of the grocery list on the side of the fridge and send it to me so that I have it while I'm shopping. That problem has gone away too. So it works. There's so many great things. So anybody, I see in our chat room here, we've got some other alternatives. One's called Grocery IQ. And then and that's from both Jim D and Karan, and then who else is it? Any List from Joel F. So we'll put all of these in the show notes. But it's great stuff, fun. I like it. It's good. Do you use anything like this, John, or do you still rock it old school?
I'm confused here because it seems the indication here is that the Notes app will not allow you to do this. And as far as I can tell,
he's on El Capitan, so he can't.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Well, but I'm looking here and it upgrade your Notes app. I'm looking at an Apple support article and they seem to indicate that you need iOS 9 or at least El Capitan in order to use some of the enhanced features. So I'm kind of scratching my head why Notes would not be an option here. It would seem, right?
Are you able to share a note with someone on El Capitan? Because I'm running El Capitan here, and I certainly can't.
Well, it's saying here with notes in iOS 9 and OS 10 El Capitan, you can turn a list into an interactive checklist.
Yes, that's correct. Right. You get all of that stuff, but you don't get the
You don't get the sharing. Okay,
share a note like by sending it to someone. But in terms of interactive or collaboration on a note, no, that's Sierra only.
All right. So you need the latest
Sierra. And I believe iOS 10. You need as well, not iOS 9. I think you have to have iOS 10 and Sierra to do the note editing. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So that's, but also, you know, in terms of groceries, I think a single purpose app is arguably better than a note, because the note can sort of get to be unruly if you don't agree and stick to a formatting convention, whereas with something like, you know, our groceries or I'm sure any of these others, it is built to do this. And so checking things off the list. And I mean, what's cool is if we tell, you know, our little Alexa unit to add something and it's already there, it will just say, okay, I've added a second one of those. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't, again, I'm looking at our chat room here.
Yeah.
And I see at least one person says, I use notes via iCloud for sharing notes with my wife who has El Capitan. So I think it is possible.
Is it?
I mean,
yeah, I would not recommend using notes for this. I mean, there's literally free alternatives that are going to work a whole lot better for you than just, you know, kind of a blob of, you know, manually organized text for this. But I don't see a way. Maybe on the web.
There is a way that, well, if there is a way, what you're going to see is if you look at a note, you're going to see a little icon that shows a little person and a little plus, and that's how you do the share. So
no, I definitely don't have that. Maybe on the web, maybe you can do it on iCloud.com on El Capitan. That's possible. But okay, yeah, Kevin's saying via the web interface is how he does it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. So, I mean, that would work, but there's no reason to do that when you've got all these great apps that we just mentioned here. So, in the quick tip category here, Brian has a question, and we've got an answer that will turn into a nice little quick tip. Brian asks, he says, I have a late 2012 Mac Mini with a Core i7. Over time, I have increased the RAM to 16 gigs and swapped out the spinning drive for a 512 gig SSD from Crucial. I recently purchased an LG 27-inch 4K Ultra HD monitor, thinking I could gain some screen real estate and end up using a resolution beyond 1080p. I connected the 4K monitor via DisplayPort, and much to my dismay, Apple has decided to restrict resolutions in macOS Sierra to scaled. And he did. He sent us a screenshot where when he goes to the system preferences display and he chooses that display, it says you can use the resolution of default for display or something called scaled, where all you see is default in the middle and then several variants heading towards larger text on the left and variants heading towards more space, more screen real estate on the right. But you're not able to pick individual resolutions. And he says, the interesting thing is when I use VMware Fusion to run various Windows versions, all of them, Windows 10 and 7, he says, can scale for 4K and I can adjust the resolution manually and get far more granular with it. So I started experimenting with this, John, and I went into System Preferences display on my Mac, and I have two monitors on my iMac in the office. Well, there's the one built in. And on that one, it says scaled. And when you choose scaled, all I see is larger text to more space with default in the middle. And then when I go on my very old, ancient, I think it's older than my children. Well, not quite. Cinema Display HD or Cinema HD Display, whichever. The one with the Lucite thing around it. The very, very first one Apple came out with. It's still running, by the way. All I see is four resolutions on that one. 1920 by 1200 and all the way down to 1024 by 640, but only four of them. I'm like, I've seen more than this. So I brought in our old friend, the option key. And when I clicked, so I went back to default for display on both of them. And when I clicked scaled, this time I held down the option key. Now, on my internal display, I see, I think, 6 or 7 different resolutions listed. None of them, like the whole larger text to more space thing that obscures the actual resolutions, went away. And I get far more. And the same is true on my cinema display. When I hold down the option key and hit scaled, I see far more resolution options there. So I'm hoping that this will work for our friend as well. So there you go. Holding down the option key, man. It's good stuff.
Yeah. I wonder why they hide things from you. What else, Apple?
Yeah. Yeah. My guess is these are the common ones. And, I don't know. I don't know why they make these choices, but it is nice to be able to get granular. And the nice part is they've left that in there. Hold down the option key and you're good to go. Fun, yeah, right?
Things may look a bit wonky. I mean, I'm looking at some of the resolutions that they suggest when you hold down the key. And some of them look like 3200 by 1800. I think that would be kind of...
Yeah, things would get weird.
It would be distorted.
Very much distorted.
That's I think right. What it shows you are ones where everything will look pretty.
Right. Yeah, and it's even on this machine, which is a 27-inch non-Retina iMac, I think from 2011... When I go to scaled, I get, there we are. And the option key is kind of a toggle thing. It seems to stick once you've done it. But I get 5 resolutions from 2560 by 440 all the way down to 1280. And then if I hold down the option key, I get many, many more. I can't even count quickly. But they go all the way down to 800 by 600 now. So I get a real, I can muck with it. I'm not going to change it while we're doing the show here because... I like where all my windows are, and I don't want to have to put them back. But
yeah, and I seem to recall there, I don't think it's necessary anymore, but I think in the early days, another option that you would have to hold down a key to bring up would be rotation, which is always kind of an interesting option because, I mean...
Yeah,
I don't know why they put it there often because who reads their screen sideways or upside down? Well, maybe some people do. Maybe you have a need...
Yeah, totally. No, I've seen people use screens on their side, especially if you're coding. If you've got a screen, turning it on its side where you've got it in, you know, what I would call portrait mode instead of landscape mode can be really handy because now you're scrolling a whole lot less. It's actually kind of cool.
Yep.
Yeah. So you get this very tall thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it shows up. Yeah, but before you used to have to do a hand wave to get the option to show up. But I'm looking right here, at least on my Mini, it gives me the option immediately. Standard 90, 180, or 270.
Right. Fun. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, it is fun. All right. Good stuff. Fun. We have a weird tip, I think, coming up that's worth sharing here, John. And it's from John, but it's not you. But it is about photos, which I know is something you like, too. He says, I have just worked out the cause of a problem I'm having in Sierra's photos that I initially assumed was due to corruption in my photos library, but actually seems just to be bad software design. John says, just before I noticed this problem, I had issues with Carbon Copy Cloner failing to back up because it was taking too long, a bit concerning as apart from my regular Time Machine backups. My last Carbon Copy Cloner backup was about a year ago. I narrowed this down to my Photos library and used the Option command whilst launching Photos to repair the library. Unfortunately, this got stuck at about 97%, and after several hours, I forced quit. Then Photos wouldn't even launch. Eventually, I ran the repair, but left it while I went out for the day. When I got home, it had completed. One little aside there that I want to share, if you are doing a repair or a migration in Photos, you know, from if you still have like an old iPhoto library or doing anything like that, open up the console and you can see the progress. You can even filter down by photo or photos, you know, in a live filter so that you can see what's happening. Because a lot of times, yeah, it will get stuck at some percentage point and you can see whether something is truly happening or if it's just stuck sitting there. And I've been in that spot, so I know how you feel and I know why you quit, because it seemed like it was stuck, but it turns out it probably wasn't. and you just let it happen. But if you're impatient like me, opening the console and filtering down to the word photo or photos can likely help you get a real picture of what's happening there. Continuing with John, he says, later, I noticed that various people, capitalized P, because there are people now in photos, showed as gray boxes. And when I clicked on them, it showed a larger gray box with a spinning white gear in the middle that even if I left overnight, didn't ever show the photo. I assumed this was due to the corruption related to the previous issue that needed repair. However, after several occasions of Googling and failing to find a solution, I eventually noticed all of the people this affected were work colleagues. I then realized that because I wanted to keep my photos library primarily for family and holiday photos, he says, I had hidden things like eBay listing photos, document photos, work photos, etc. So the explanation was that the people whose photos were all hidden showed as gray boxes with a spinning white gear. He says, I've reported this as a bug to Apple, but whether they regard it to be a bug or just poor software design, I don't know. I just thought it was worth sharing with others, he says, as I spent quite a while trying to work this out. Yeah, so if you're hiding different photo types, it seems the people associated with those photos get hidden as well if they're lumped in together. Very, very interesting how photos, again, I guess we're back to Apple doing its part to, I don't know.
Obfuscate?
Yeah, obfuscate things. I like that word. It's good. Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Cool. Thanks for the tip, John. Very, very good stuff. We have a tip from Dave, too. So we've had a tip from John and a tip from Dave, and they're not you and me. But I'm going to share Dave's tip now, unless there's anything else you want to talk about with John's, with his photos one, John?
Go.
Go. All right. Dave writes, he says, I'm a longtime listener, huge fan. He says, I'm just now listening to episode 640 and heard the question about running a Retina MacBook Pro in closed lid mode while running two displays. I had to take a minute and write you guys as I've recently discovered something on this issue. I have a mid-2012 15-inch non-Retina MacBook Pro and had been happily using it in closed lid mode with a vertical dock from Hinge Docks and an external display, keyboard, and mouse. I've been doing this for several years with no problems, and I use the machine for web development and typically hit the CPU pretty hard with a Linux virtual machine running VirtualBox, all sorts of other things. My company, says, recently switched to using Zoom.us for video conferencing, which has a dedicated app and works quite well. My dev team uses the screen share feature regularly when we need to collaborate on a project. When sharing my screen, this app streams video at the full native resolution. And he says, in his case, 2560 by 1440. So it must be a, yeah, right. That's size screen. He says, adding this CPU intensive task on top of everything else going on during a typical workday, and I would experience some major system performance issues. The MacBook Pro would become almost unresponsive. I've been trying to track it down so far with no luck. iStat menus and activity monitor would both show kernel task using the most CPU by far, typically around 300%. He says, I finally found an Apple support article explaining that in certain conditions, when an app needs a lot of CPU power, the OS will attempt to throttle the CPU back using kernel task as sort of the scapegoat, if you will. It just assigns the CPU to kernel task and therefore it throttles it back. This is not the same as hardware throttling itself due to heat. Some of the conditions were high heat readings, low voltage, faulty battery, etc. My battery needed replacing anyway, so I replaced it with a new one from OWC, but had no improvement. Finally, I took the MacBook Pro out of the dock, plugged all my peripherals back in, and no more kernel task throttling. Seems simple enough, right? He says the MacBook Pro must have been running too hot with the lid closed inside the dock, so software throttling kicked in. The funny thing here is that my temperatures right now are about the same or sometimes higher than before. Now I'm running the internal display and the external, so that may have something to do with it. My guess, he says, after all of this, is that there must be a separate set of rules for CPU throttling when the lid is closed versus when it's open. Even though my temps are the same or sometimes higher, the fans rarely run anymore. I haven't encountered a single case of CPU throttling, he says. So he says, I've since purchased a laptop cooler tray with a fan to try and keep it as cool as possible while working. He says, I don't think the issue was the dock. I tested running with the lid closed on top of the laptop cooler, and I get the exact same performance problems as before. So this is very interesting that Apple, as we said back in 640 when we were talking about this, John, that they totally support closed lid mode. But clearly, they've put some things in place to keep you from overcooking yourself when you're in that mode. And sometimes that's going to mean getting actually less out of your CPU just because you're in closed lid mode. I think this is worth some more testing. If anybody out there has experienced this and has any either anecdotal or you know, direct evidence as to this happening or specifically not happening, I'd love to hear about it because this is the first I've heard of this. But it totally makes sense. So I'd be really curious to hear about it. Have you heard anything about this, John?
You know, I seem to recall something. So one thing that's key in the clamshell mode, which I didn't notice initially here.
Yeah.
Or closed display mode is what they call it.
Right? Yeah, closed lid mode, I think, or something. Yeah, right. But yes,
well, I actually have the article here. So use your Mac notebook computer in closed display mode. The other thing I noticed is that they seem to have changed the layout of the support articles. They look different. Different font or something. But anyways, one requirement that you may want to keep in mind, and I seem to recall this back in the mists of time here. One thing they say here is that you have to be connected to an AC power adapter.
Right.
And I seem to recall something in my mind here that if you were in clamshell mode and you were on battery power, certain things would happen. And I think including perhaps scaling things back a bit.
Sure. Yeah, that would make sense. With him, he's obviously on power because he's connected to the hinge dock, which is, you know, naturally powering the thing.
Which I would think, yes, provides power for you.
But, very interesting. Very cool stuff. I love it. I love this stuff. You know what else I love, John? I love tasty food, man. And I really actually like cooking with my family. It's really fun. And Blue Apron is our first sponsor for this episode. And if you visit blueapron.com/MGG, you can get the ingredients. And these are fresh, great, tasty ingredients. And recipe is almost the wrong word because it doesn't quite describe it well enough. These are like picture laden. I mean, there's written instructions too, but these are instructions. It's a how to use these ingredients to make this awesome meal, full meal. We're not just talking about, you know, it's just going to make your entree and you have to worry about the sides or anything. No, this is a full meal. And if you visit blueapron.com/MGG, you get 3 free meals and they'll all be shipped to you for free. And we're talking tasty stuff. Pimento cheeseburgers is on the menu for this week. Pesto shrimp and gnocchi. Spinach and sweet potato quesadillas. That's on the family plan. They have a 2-person plan as well. Seared chicken and pan sauce. Crispy barramundi. Sicilian cauliflower pizza. Cumin crusted pork. Really tasty stuff. And like I said, these how-tos, and they're beautifully printed and stuff. You could keep these and then go, if you like one of these recipes, you could go get more ingredients yourself, of course. And you know, approximate this same thing. And now you've sort of added something new to your arsenal, you know, of things when planning your menu. So it's really fun. And because you get this how-to that's printed, it makes it way easier for the entire family to participate. I know with us, we all like to cook, to be perfectly honest. And, you know, before we had kids, Lisa and I cooked together a lot. I cooked, for her, she would cook for me and we cooked together. But now we've just sort of gotten into a routine. And the hard part about that routine is, you know, Lisa has a lot of these recipes and sort of the processes, even more importantly, in her head. And so it's difficult for us to really participate with each other. She can sort of delegate out, but with these instructions, we're all starting from the same spot and we have all the instructions out there. And so we can follow this stuff. It's really, really great. Really tasty. Great ingredients. They ship it to you. So you got to check this out. Go to blueapron.com/MGG and you get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping. Blue Apron guarantees freshness on every ingredient and make sure your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll take care of it for you because that's who they are. You're going to love how much fun it is, how great it tastes. Check it out. blueapron.com/MGG. Our thanks to Blue Apron for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. You know what else I like talking about? I like talking about routers. I don't know if you figured that out.
What's a router?
A router is that thing that you put between all of your network and the rest of the internet. And it does a couple of things, right? It shares your internet connection, whatever you get from your ISP with all your devices. Oftentimes it creates your wireless network for you. Most of the time, that's how they're set up. Provides some security, all of that good stuff. Scott has a comment about router security, John, that I'd like to share, if that's all right with you.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay. So Scott says, listening to Matt Geekab 640, he says, I want to provide my advice on all networking issues. Number one, regardless of ISP, do not use the ISP's equipment to manage your home security. Even if the ISP has benevolent reasons to check your connection and tell you about your security, the fact of the matter is they have access to your network. Do you really trust them to have that type of view? He says, I use a router running DDWRT, separating my home network from my ISP. And he says, number two, do you trust your ISP with your Wi-Fi? Folks like Comcast and Xfinity have a setting to share your Wi-Fi as part of their global network. Do you trust them with that? He says, what about AirPress? And he goes on and on. So he says, if you don't manage and it's a good lesson. If you don't manage and control your network, you better trust your ISP because they have control over you. Mm-hmm. And he's right about that. That said, ISPs tend to ship pretty decent routers today. And we were having a discussion on our Mac Geekab Facebook group about routers, actually, as I was prepping kind of the agenda for today's show. And somebody was asking about bang for the buck with routers. And actually several people sort of piled onto that request saying, yeah, you know, you talk about all these routers on the show. I would love to hear what advice you have in terms of bang for the buck. And as I was just sort of, you know, stream of consciousness typing, I found myself, what I said was, and I believe this, there's really no reason to go out if all you want to spend on a router is, you know, somewhere between $50 and $100. There's really no reason to go out and buy a router. There's nothing in that range that I would recommend over just using the router that your cable company ships you. Assuming that they do ship you one, it's probably going to be better than whatever you're going to go out and buy for $50 to $100. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are fine routers at that price, but they're not going to have like super great Wi-Fi. They're not going to have super fast CPUs. They're just going to be average run-of-the-mill routers, and your cable company's probably going to give you something better. And here's the thing, your cable company, because they're providing you a router, every year you can go back to them and say, hey, I want an upgrade. And it just comes as part of the fee you're paying regularly. My feeling is that if you're going to go out and buy a router for yourself, the point is to keep that thing and run it for somewhere between 3 maybe to 5 years. I mean, it beyond that, probably not, right? But if you're going to do that, I think it's worth spending, you know, the right routers to get started about the $150 range. Certainly, you can go up to like $500. And I'm talking about standalone routers. I'm kind of leaving mesh out of the discussion for this week. But because there's a lot of homes where one router is enough. And so I think, you know, moving your bar up to that 150 number, I don't think you're going to need to spend $500, most of you. In fact, I'm about to tell you about a router that sits at like 225, maybe even 200, that is absolutely my favorite standalone router that I've ever encountered, to be perfectly honest. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I know I'm teasing a little bit here, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, John, as I've spouted about here for you.
I personally have what my ISP provided, and then currently my router is the Eero. But
you never had a router from your ISP, though, did you? We're talking about routers, not cable
yes,
modems.
Yes, I understand that.
Okay, right.
Cable modem. Yeah, I'm just laying out the scenario here. So I have the cable modem, and I've always had what they've provided.
Yeah,
and provide my own router. But a little while ago, so my parents have a different ISP. At one point, they said, "Hey, you know, your crummy Doxus 2 thing. We want to give you something better.
Right.
And before, I had them in a situation where the airport was their router.
Right.
Providing the wireless and, of course, the routing among their things. But then when they ship this new modem, this is an all-in-one that's kind of a co-branded thing. It's Xfinity, but it's actually an Aris,
yeah.
A-R-R-I-S.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, I looked at everything that provided. I was given or made aware of the password and changed it. So you could change some of the advanced settings on it. It's really not a bad router at all. So it provides... you know, it provides the Ethernet ports, and it also provides 802.11ac.
Yeah.
You know, I hooked it up, tried it, provisioned it. That was kind of frustrating. I got bounced to like three different people before they were able to provision it properly. One of them even, you know, this was the kind of a fish shake. You
and
know,
this was Xfinity, to. Right?
Correct.
That's so weird because their provisioning process, I've done it because I've, you know, tested a bunch of cable modems or whatever over the last year. I've provisioned probably six different cable modems and haven't talked to a single rep. You just plug your computer directly into the thing and it gets an IP and you plug in your account information and it provisions the modem. You're good to go.
That's how it's supposed to work, but it didn't. It kept getting caught in this loop where it kept going back to step one and I'm like, oh man. So then I got on the phone.
Yeah, then you have to get on the phone. Sure.
Then I don't know what the problem was, but I finally, on the third try, got someone who knew what was going on and fixed it.
Sure.
One guy was actually like, well, I think we got to send out charge you for a service call. And I'm like, no, dude, your stuff
doesn't work. Yeah. So,
you promise.
So it sounds like to reel you back in from this tangential story here that you tend to agree the routers that you've seen coming from ISPs when the ISP provides it. And I get that yours doesn't, but the ones that you've seen, are adequate, capable.
Oh, it's fine. Yeah. And I even decided to pull the airport out of the mix because it was actually a more, their airport was the cable modem or router that they provided was more capable than the airport. So I'm like, you know what? Let's take it out of the equation.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So I wouldn't
necessarily not use what they offer, which I think is what Scott's trying to say. He's like, you know, trust no one, which I appreciate
I get
the sentiment.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. You know, so here's the thing again, and we've got Andy in the chat room reminding us about the TP-Link C7 and, you know, even the C8 and C9 are I think there's a C8, isn't there? But there's certainly a C9. They're all available.
Oh, yeah.
In that, you know, probably $100 and even sub-$100 range. And they are very capable routers. They're not the best Wi-Fi. They don't have the best Wi-Fi range on them, to be brutally honest. But they're okay. Again, I just don't think they're going to be a whole lot better than what you're going to get from your cable company, if at all. In fact, I think the cable company might provide you a better router than those in terms of reach and all of that stuff. So I feel like, you know, if you're looking at this and saying, well, I'm going to spend $70 on this router, you know, this TP-Link thing. Well, why not look at something a little bit more? And I, like I said, I'm about to tell you about something that's, you know, triple that price in the, you know, 200 to 220 range. But it's worth it in terms of getting true wireless range, true speed and all of that stuff. And this router, I've been testing, as I said last week, the new Synology RT2600AC. So this is Synology's second router. And yes, you know I'm a huge fan of Synology's disk stations. That's not necessarily why I like their router. In fact, when they came out with the RT1900AC, I was curious about it. We talked about it here. It certainly was on my short list of routers. But my one hesitation was... how far is Synology going to go with this? You know, for how many years am I going to be able to use this router with software updates? This is, you know, is this just a flash in the pan in terms of a change to their product line, or are they really committed to this? With the RT2600AC, I feel that question has been answered, not only with the existence of this router, but with the software updates that keep coming for the previous one. And the software is a huge part of this. You know, John, I've been a fan of the DDWRT third-party firmware for a long time. I can't, I wouldn't, like, there was nothing else that I could live with using as my main router. I mean, I would test all kinds of other things, and certainly with the mesh stuff, I mean, the way that wireless works is stellar. But in terms of managing my network, there were some things about DDWRT that just gave me the flexibility to do what I wanted to do. SRM is what Synology calls their router manager software. And it's the nice part is, it's like, even though the routers are only a couple of years old in terms of the product line, SRM feels like a, 10-year mature product because it's based on Disk Station Manager, DSM. It's that same type of web interface you get, really easy to do stuff, but immensely powerful. You don't have to dig deep. If you just want to set up a network, you can just set up a quick network and you're good. But if you want to go nuts, you can go really nuts with this thing. And I haven't hit a wall yet. So this podcast actually is, our Skype connection is happening over the 2600 AC, John. I have been running it as my main edge router for a week here. It is the first time in 10 years that I truly feel like I won't be going back to DDWRT anytime soon. I can do everything I want to do with this, even all my crazy geeky stuff. And this router rocks. The Wi-Fi on it is killer. It's an AC 2600 router, which means it's 800 megabits per second on the 2.4 gigahertz and 1733 on the 5 gigahertz. And the reason it can do that is because both of those radios are 4x4 radios, meaning there's four antennas. It's 802.11 AC wave 2, which means it can go up to full, 160 megahertz bandwidth if the clients support it. And of course, I don't have any clients that'll support that. But what it does is, because it has these four radios, kind of like the Netgear Orbi, right? Remember we talked about the crazy backhaul on that Netgear Orbi and how good it was? 4x4 radios. These things, because there's more antennas, there's more streams happening, and they're able to kind of maximize their usage for clients. It's amazing. I used to run three access points in my house with my quasi mesh. With this, I turned off the access points and I get full bandwidth everywhere in the house. It's insane. And because the software is fantastic, they use something called Smart Connect, John, which has, as we've talked about lately, the router participating in that discussion of whether or not your client should be on the 2.4 or the 5 gigahertz band. And here's the even cooler part, John. You can control how it makes that decision. And by default, it's just on auto, but you can change it to custom. It's called the Wireless Smart Connect Scheme. And there's two sets of parameters. One is based on signal strength. So you can say if the 2.4 gigahertz signal is greater than X, then that means that the device is close enough, bounce them to the 5. If it's less than this on the 5, bounce them back to the 2.4. And you can do load balancing. So you can say, look, if either one of these is, loaded it to 80% capacity or more, bounce it to the other one. And that's like the defaults, but you can change those if you want, to get crazy. So it's just, it's really, really well done. Port forwarding, the firewall is super easy to use. I've never had a firewall user interface graphically that's as simple as this. I wanted to block some packets coming in and out the other day. I just put it in, and then I realized it wasn't working because it was at the bottom of my firewall chain or too late in the chain, and I had other rules that were allowing them. So I just dragged it up, and boom, then it started blocking those packets. Really nice. Cool. Yeah, it's real. I mean,
I remember reading up a bit on this whole band steering, I guess they call it.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, that's the right term to use, I think.
Where it's like, no. You don't want to make that choice. You want to make this choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the client sometimes gets it wrong.
The client doesn't know. Right.
It's, hey, there's the strongest signal. I better choose that. It's like, well, no, it's not such a great idea.
Yeah, I have more information than you. Right.
In edge cases, that may not be the best strategy.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's right. Yes. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no. I like this. I'm looking at the description of the. So wait, how do they get 2600? What numbers add up?
So we're adding 800 megabits on the 2.4 channel and 1733 on the 5 gigahertz. So we're at 2533. Oh, okay. That's where they get 2600. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Close enough.
Yeah, it's close enough.
What but I do this, like is the VPN support here.
Dude.
So I'm looking at all the wonderful features that they have. So having a VPN built into a router is a nice feature that not all of them have.
This is like the best VPN software I've ever used because it's the same. It's actually better VPN software than you and I get in than any of us get in the Synology Disk Station Manager because well, it's sitting
it's the same.
No, it's it. I know so because I have both. Oh. Okay. Yeah. So you actually install a package called VPN Plus Server. So it has a built-in VPN, but then the Synology provided package. You put a USB stick in to hold your packages. We all have an extra USB stick around. So that I just put one of those in. It formatted it up. You're good to go. And this VPN Plus will do all of what we'll call standard VPN, which includes the only router that I know of at the moment that supports L2TP, which is the best VPN option to use that's built into both iOS and macOS in terms of client support. So you don't need to add any apps to your Mac or your iPhone in order to connect to the L2TP VPN. It works great. Mm. So there's that. And then OpenVPN, of course, it does support PP. Yeah, it does support PPTP, but that's like none of our clients support that anymore because it's too insecure. But the L2TP setup is like painless. You just type in, you know, the things you want and you're done. And then on top of that, it has Synology VPN, which doesn't exist to my knowledge in Disk Station Manager yet. My guess is it probably will. And this is like a web SSL based VPN. It's a whole different thing. You do need clients, but it allows you all sorts of crazy management stuff and all of that too. But as you can tell, I'm really excited about this. It's been a long time since I've been excited about the firmware of a router. I mean, most of these routers do okay. And like, I mean, you know, like the Eero and that's really the best of the mesh right now in terms of firmware, because it just has enough features for most of us to use and do a little bit of geeky things. Luma's not too far behind, but they're a little bit far behind. Netgear is, I feel like, the one that's going to catch up and possibly surpass Eero, and because the hardware's got some of that cool stuff I mentioned. But in terms of router firmware, I try them all. This is like leaps and bounds beyond what anybody else is doing out there. And I'm really loving it. The one thing I will complain about, and I've already shaken my fist at Synology about this, the QoS support. It has QoS support. It works. Except that it actually causes more latency and packet loss than not using it. So I go in and I say, you know, I've got whatever, 200, let's say I've got 200 megabits down. I have a little more than that. 200 megabits down and 10 up, right? So I set the QoS at 190 down and 9 up, let's just say. And then I test my packet loss, you know, and ping times and all that. Without QoS, I get no packet loss, and I get maybe, you know, 60 milliseconds increase in ping times, especially on an upload test. Okay, fine. With QoS, I start getting some packet loss when it hits the wall, and I get maybe 80 millisecond increase in ping times. And I've asked them about this. I'm like, guys, what queuing methodology are you using here? Because there are better queuing methodologies available in the software that you have on my router. Can I pick a different one? And they say, yes, we're talking to our engineers about it. So,
yeah, because it has, I'm looking here. So it has a 1.7 gigahertz dual core processor. That's pretty.
It's fast enough to do this
for a router.
Yeah. It just need, we just need to use the right QoS queuing methodology. We'll get them there. They're very receptive to this kind of stuff. And of course, they've got forums. And remember, I mentioned that I installed the VPN Plus server package from Synology. Well, there's third-party packages for the routers, too. There's not a whole lot for the 2600 yet because it literally just came out, but there's a ton of them for the 1900, like adding things like iPerf if you want that and, you know, other stuff. So I'm really, really stoked on this. And, of course, it has dynamic DNS support. Somebody in the chat room, Joel F., was asking, do you need a static IP on your WAN connection to do VPN? Absolutely not. No, you can use dynamic DNS. So, for example, I'm not going to give you what my Synology.me name is, but you could potentially, I could set up DaveHamilton.Synology.me as my mapped, dynamic DNS address. That's not what I use. But I could use that if somebody else isn't already. And then if I want to connect to a VPN, I just put in DaveHamilton.Synology.me. And it doesn't matter what my IP address, my router keeps Synology up to date. And then that DNS looks up. But I can also use like no IP and Dyn DNS and all of that stuff. Synology supports all of those services. And CloudStation server can run on this router. So for those of you that were thinking about getting a disk station so that you could have your own like private Dropbox thing, you still can do that, but CloudStation server runs on this too. So you can hang a USB drive off of it, big as you want, and point CloudStation at that. And now you've got, it's like Dropbox. There's apps for your Mac that just sync. You've heard us talk about CloudStation before. The router supports it natively. It's pretty cool stuff, John. I'm really, as you can
look
tell.
Look at this. And the WAN, smart WAN.
Yes.
So they do load balances. Wow, that's
right. Oh, no. We've had a lot of people.
I don't know of any router. I mean, I know the Synology, select Synologies, and I think I set mine up for that and then didn't. I think
no,
I
you can,
again.
If you have two WAN connections, so this is weird, but you might have a connection from your ISP, you might have two ISPs, and I've heard of some people in Europe doing this, because they only get an X amount of bandwidth from one and then X amount from another for a month. So you can, you can have both of them connected to this at the same time. And you can set it up that it's for failover or for bandwidth usage. And you can, yeah, it's amazing. It's crazy. Like I said, it's a really nice interface, but it's got some crazy features that, that let you do all this stuff. I love it. Anyway.
So what's the punchline? How much would you pay for such a product?
It's only like I said, I think my guess is it's going to settle in at like $199. But right now, if you want one, you're paying about $225.
Oh, wow.
So, well, look, compare that to the Nighthawk X8.
Oh, wow. That's not bad for features that they cram in there.
That's what I'm saying. It's really not bad. Yeah. Yeah. You've got kind of a NAS Lite, right, where it's not quite a full-fledged, disk station, but you've got kind of some of those things, and it's got a media server in it if you want to do that too, and then this like total kick-ass router. So,
oh yeah, I saw that DLNA, my favorite thing.
Yeah, it supports DLNA. It supports SNMP if you want that, John.
Ooh,
yeah, it's fun
for people that want to poke their or talk to their router. What are you doing?
But it also does its own reporting. Like it'll tell you what device is doing what, and you can do parental controls by device and all of that stuff. Like I said, the one part where it's a little weak is the QoS is just a little weird. But it's better than it was with the RT1900. I mean, it's like the software keeps evolving. So it'll get there. It'll get there. Like for example, I had a big problem with the RT1900 when I tested it, because the only way I could enter in my internet speeds, and by the way, I shouldn't have to enter in my internet speeds. It should be testing them once a day and setting it automatically. So Synology folks, take that as a feature request.
Yeah. I know some other people do that.
Eero does it. Luma does it. Yeah. You should do this too, Synology. But when you entered it, the only way you could enter it was kilobytes per second. Now, if you're doing speed tests, you're getting speed in either kilobits or megabits per second. And I didn't think about this because I just saw it in the UI. I saw K with a capital B, PS, and I thought, well, okay, I'll just put this in. And it caused all kinds of problems because I was putting in these impossibly high numbers for kilobytes. And then finally it hit me one day. I was like, wait a minute. They're not asking for kilobits. They're asking for kilobytes. So I had to do the math with the divide by 8 and this, that, and the other thing. And then it works out fine. Of course, Google will just do it. But you got to type in, whatever kilobits per second or megabits per second to kilobytes. And then it all works out and it's fine. But they changed it in the UI now. In SRM, you can choose kilobytes if that's what you had before. Or now you can choose kilobits for a different unit. So they're evolving this stuff.
Yeah.
It's good. Yeah.
I remember having the same thing with TP-Link, is that they would only allow inputting the speeds in megabits per second.
Okay. And you couldn't do half a megabit or something?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The thing is, I wanted to do like whatever point, whatever, because that was, the threshold that I was trying to reach. And it's like, nope, no decimal points.
Yeah.
Single digits only.
Yeah.
which wasn't really the level of granularity that I wanted. But
all right, we're on this router subject. We are going to break what would be one of my rules that we never really talk about, and that is we're going to have kind of extended segments on sort of the same topic, probably 2 weeks in a row, because I'm almost finished testing Google Wi-Fi. And literally yesterday, the new Linksys Velop stuff arrived, and there's been some firmware updates to some of the other mesh products. So we're going to do a little bit on mesh next week, I think. We might put it off a second week, but I don't know. You guys let us know if you want us to put that off a second week. Because I don't like to just obsess and turn this into either, you know, router geek gab or disk, you know, network attached storage geek gab or whatever it is. Yeah. But we do have a couple of other things about routers to talk about. So while we're here, we're just going to keep doing it, John. And that is listener Joe, back to the concept of third-party firmware, highly recommends something called uTangle firmware, which is at uTangle.com, uTangle.com. He says, this is firmware you should really know about. He says, I have an industrial strength that yet home user easy Linux-based thing, and I'm trying to think of what the best way is to talk about this. He says, we're talking on par with Barracuda, SonicWall, etc., yet very affordable for the masses. I hear you mention good options to users for stout home protection, and frankly, this is in a different grade than the mainstream consumer brands out there. I wanted to ask you to plug uTangle, because from listening to some of their support videos, it's pretty clear they're taking a financial gamble, sticking their neck out, trying to reach out to the home prosumer user. And so what's interesting is it's just a firmware. You can install it on your, like, you can set up a little Linux box, but you can also buy sort of a, you know, I don't know if a Raspberry Pi would run uTangle. It might. But they've got some little boxes that you can buy to put it on and all that stuff. So we'll put a link in the show notes about this. And he says, yeah, the U25, which is a 3-port deck of cards sized, but no wireless, is $399, a single antenna rig with Wi-Fi for $419. So these are not inexpensive when you're in the consumer grade. And so anyway, we'll put a link to uTangle in the show notes here, because I think perhaps there's something to that. We like to keep on top of everything, you know. That really was the reason I was and still am a fan of DDWRT. Is 10 years ago, it gave me features that I could not have in a home Wi-Fi router, like VPN. There was just no way to get that. Nobody was offering that back then. It was only a couple of years ago that people started doing that. You know, that kind of stuff you will see in these alternative firmwares, and they will come out. But DDWRT has kind of flattened out in terms of that. They keep everything up to date. So from a security standpoint, they're doing a fine job there with DDWRT. But in terms of features, like, they added L2TP VPN because I asked them to when Apple sort of stopped using PPTP. But you need like a Windows machine to configure it and go through this whole mess. It's like they're just clearly not prioritizing the user experience anymore with DDWRT. So, but uTangle's another one. Somebody else always steps in. Opportunity knocks. From Bob, John. Bob, again, we're sticking with the router thing for a couple of minutes here, and then we have some other things to go through. Bob says, recently we changed our internet providers to Time Warner Cable that gives me a dual band router. When we made that switch, we began having issues with our HP printer to be recognized by our laptops. We didn't have this problem before. I could either turn off the Wi-Fi or the power on the printer and start it back up, and it would work for one job. I can't imagine this old printer would work on the 5 gigahertz band, but they should be able to talk across bands since it's the same router. Even so, I made both frequencies have the same password, so it acts as the same Wi-Fi no matter what. This did not fix the problem. I even turned off the 5 gigahertz band just to see if that was causing issues, but that didn't seem to help either. And in fact, now my printer won't connect via Wi-Fi at all anymore. I've turned 5 gigahertz back on. I've reset the Wi-Fi settings on the printer, but to no avail. The printer works fine when connected directly. Do you or your listeners have any ideas as to why this might be happening? I think disabling the 5 gigahertz band rules out any of that band confusion that sometimes you hear about with dual band routers and older devices like this. And this does sometimes happen. I here's the thing about that, though. It would only happen if something like we just talked about with Synology, with the Smart Connect, where the router was actually denying connections from a device on one band, trying to move it to the other. If your printer doesn't support 5 gigahertz, your printer's not going to get confused because it's not going to see any other radio available, right? If the printer only supports 2.4 gigahertz, it's not going to see your 5 gigahertz radio. That's just how physics works. So, so unless your new router has some band steering in it, the router shouldn't have a problem. And I have heard people on the Synology forums that have, you know, kind of some older odd devices saying band steering wasn't working for them. They needed to turn that off, or Smart Connect or whatever it was called. But it's possible your printer needs to be factory reset, not just having the Wi-Fi reset. It could be looking for the MAC address of your old Wi-Fi access point. I have seen that. My brother went through some of that when we set up the Luma at his house because of for some reason, these printers, instead of just looking for Wi-Fi at an address, they start looking for, you know, the MAC address of the Wi-Fi access point that had that address. And sometimes it just doesn't work out all that well. So I think a factory reset, that's where I would start. Any thoughts on that, John?
I'm looking up the product on the HP site.
Okay.
They do have a, getting started with wireless guide.
Yeah.
We reviewed that. They may dispense with some wisdom.
Yeah.
Kind of like you, like, yeah, reset this or reset that.
Yeah. I would go with a factory reset of the printer, just to wipe everything out. And I realize it's a little bit of a pain in the neck, but it's a printer. There's not that many settings to reconfigure. And most of those settings probably are stored on your individual computers, you know, your client devices, as well. So,
yeah, they have specific section here, solving wireless 802.11 problems. So,
yeah,
give that a whirl, or maybe reinstall the driver software. Who knows?
Well, if anybody out there has any thoughts, I don't think it's it's not a driver issue. If the printer's not connecting to Wi-Fi, that has nothing to do with drivers on the clients. So it's just about getting the printer itself to connect to your Wi-Fi network. But I would reset the printer entirely. That helped when we moved my dad over to his Eero, and also when we moved my brother over to the Luma. He had an Epson printer that was giving him fits because of the kind of the different.
Yeah, here we go. Here's how to solve the problem.
How?
It seems this printer itself has a wireless network test on it. So within the control panel of the printer itself.
Right.
So, hey, run that and see what it complains about.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems to have the ability to say, hey, here's what's wrong with my Wi-Fi. But I suspect your solution is...
hopefully.
They turn it off and on again.
Yeah. Well, not just turn it off.
Turn it off. Right. I know. Reset. Yeah. But yeah. Make it think it's new.
Right. Right. All right. And then an interesting thing from Roger. He upgraded from whatever router he had previously to an Eero and started having weird problems when he was streaming, anything that was streaming for a while. And so it was his modem resetting. And so he called up Eero and asked about this, and they asked him what kind of, they worked through a bunch of stuff with him. And then they asked him what kind of modem he had. And he said he had an Aeris 6183, which is a DOCSIS 3 modem, 16x4. Out there, many, many, many of them. But as soon as he said that, Eero said, Aeris has identified that there is a bug in the firmware of the 6183 that for whatever reason causes problems when we're doing streaming. My guess is it has to do with the way Eero is doing QoS, because Eero's probably throttling things on the inbound as it should to manage this QoS stuff, and perhaps the cable modem's buffers are filling up. I don't know. I'm guessing at all this, but that would make sense. And they said there's a bug in the firmware. Well, the only way you can update the firmware on your cable modem is to call your cable company. It doesn't matter if it's theirs or yours. They provide the firmware 100% of the time. So he couldn't go to Aeris and get this new firmware. He did call his cable company. They said they were going to push out a firmware update. It turned out to be the same update that, or the same firmware that he already had. There is a support article at Eero talking about this and that you need a better firmware. But if your ISP doesn't have that firmware, you know, certified in their system yet, you are not going to get it. And there is no way to get it. So he wound up solving the problem by spending a little more money and upgrading to the Aeris 6190, which is a 32x8 cable modem, 32 download streams, 8 upload streams. And his problems were solved. I don't think the streams had anything to do with it. It just happens to be a more capable modem. But these things can happen. And as much as it stinks to have to go and spend a little bit of money, Roger's solution is certainly the fastest one in that scenario. There is literally nothing you can do if your cable company can't provide you the firmware for your modem that's going to work. So just throwing that out there. Thank you for sharing that with us, Roger. Good stuff. Kind of crazy, but that's how it works. Along with the firmware from your cable company comes a profile that tells your modem how fast to go. So like if you get, like, you know, I was saying before, I get 200 megabits down and 10 megabits up. Well, my cable company, Xfinity in this case, it's my modem that decides how fast my connection is. So there's some secure way of them pumping this profile into it that I can't go in and tweak. And they set it to actually, I think, 242,000 kilobits per second and, I don't know, 12,488 kilobits per second on the upstream. And so that way I get at least my 210 that they promised me. But that's just a little profile they send down with the firmware. So it's interesting stuff how it all works, right?
Yeah, I had fun watching.
What's that?
When I pled my case and they're like,
Right. They pushed a new profile. Yeah.
And they were like, it should take about 20 minutes for it. Like, wow. No, it's already done.
Yeah, we're all set. That's right.
I mean, I watched it happening as I was on the phone with the representative, is that they power cycled my modem. Here comes the speed.
Yeah. All right. So we got two questions and a tip that we're going to make a tip sandwich here. Gary has a question. We're finished with the networking segment of the show. And he says, I bought an Apple Watch Series 1 Sport from QVC, and I am liking everything about it. The only problem I'm having now is before I got the watch, I used to be able to get my iMessage text messages on my Mac. My late 2015 iMac is running macOS Sierra 10.2. My iPhone 7 is running iOS 10.2. My Apple Watch is running watchOS 3.1. I'm getting all of my iPhone notifications on my watch just fine. But I really liked iMessages in the Messages app feature. If Apple is making us choose one or the other, then this deserves a double fist shake. No, that's not true. Apple's not making you choose. It is possible that this simply got disabled on your Mac. I and many of us are able to get our iMessage and SMS notification. And I'm not sure whether you say iMessages, but you might also mean SMS. I'm not sure which, if it's both that aren't working or if it's just the one. But I'm able to get all of them on my Mac and on my watch when I'm wearing it. All just fine. I bet the kind of the link between it all got reset. So there's a couple of things to do. First, on your Mac, go into System Preferences and iCloud. And in there, make sure you are signed in to the same iCloud account. I know this seems really obvious, but it's a good place to start. And then once you're signed in, launch Messages on your Mac. And go to Messages Preferences, and in the Accounts section, which is, I think, the second one over, make sure that your iMessage account is attached to the same Apple ID, it should be, and that it is enabled. A lot of times, that won't happen. and then it becomes a problem. Make sure that you have at least one phone number and one email address checked in the you can be reached at for messages here, and then choose where you want to start new conversations and all of that, and whether or not you want to send read receipts. Once you've got that in place, and if you didn't have any of that in place, then that would explain why all of this wasn't working. But once you've got that in place, now go to your iPhone and go to Settings, Messages, and inside there, you're going to want to go to text message forwarding. At this point, because you're signed into to both iMessage and iCloud from your Mac, you should see your Mac in this list. SMS or text message forwarding might not be on, though. If you want it on, turn it on. And then you'll get all the green bubble messages on your Mac in addition to the blue bubble messages. And if you turn it on, what will happen is your Mac will actually display a code that you need to then enter on your iPhone to confirm that you want to, you know, kind of complete the circle and do the link. And everything should be okay. And if you did all of this, or you looked and all of this was already done, guess what? Turn it off, turn it back on again. And that includes disabling the iMessage account on your Mac. If it's working on your phone, leave it on your phone. But in iMessage or in Messages settings accounts, Messages preferences accounts, click the disable this account button, switch to a different account to force it to save, switch back to that one, click enable this account. That would, in theory, kind of rebuild that link between everything. There are lots of security keys that need to be exchanged, and it's possible that your Mac just got off of Apple's list in that process. Right?
I remember you and I going through that once.
Yeah.
Where I was like, but I'm logged in, and I'm logged in with this account. Why am I not getting my messages? Well,
yeah.
Yeah. So you have to
turn it off, turn it on.
Trick it into reestablishing, as you said. There's all these session keys and private keys and public keys.
Yeah, that's right.
And it just gets confused. Sometimes.
It just gets confused. Yeah. All right. A quick little tip from listener Mark, who says, I was listening to last episode, Mac Geek Cab 641, on speeding up a listener's sluggish iMac. He says, you guys mentioned disk defragmenting the hard drive. In the show, you recommended using a utility to do this. There is another way that is free. Copy files from the internal drive to a backup drive, erase the files from the internal drive, and then copy the files back again. I recommend using a tool like Carbon Copy Cloner to ensure a validated copy of the files is made before erasing them. And he's not necessarily talking about cloning the whole drive off and then wiping the whole drive, although that would also defragment things. But he's saying just defragment like your home folder and things in the, you know, applications and library folders. If you're going to bother to do that, my feeling would be this is good advice to a point. A lot of the fragmentation does come from your home files and all of that. But I feel like just as much of it, especially over the period of years, comes from your operating system upgrades as well and applications upgrades. And he includes that here. So I feel like if you're going to go through this and do it this way, instead of using third party software, just clone it, erase the drive and clone it back again. And then that way everything's defragmented. You got kind of a fresh start. That's my feeling. Any thoughts on that, John? It is good advice.
The statement, there's another way to do it that's free. The thing is, I don't think Carbon Copy Cloner is free. So you'd have to pay for that.
That's true.
You could
that's
use right. Apple's. You could use Apple's. Could you?
Yes.
Could you do?
Yeah.
With disk utility, I guess you could also do it if you wanted to.
Yeah,
I get the sense, though, that Drive Genius does some smart things, whereas obviously
it does
copying files. It doesn't really apply any intelligence to how it lays them out. Whereas again, I'm almost certain last I watched it that it's like, oh, okay, well, let me put all this type of file here and this type of file here. And
right.
So,
yeah,
it's good to mention a thrifty option. It certainly can't make matters worse.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I hear why you hesitated. No, you're right. Completing this successfully certainly won't make things worse. It will defragment each file and they will all be back kind of the right way. Now, whether or not that's, you know, I don't know. We'll see. We shall see. All right. Last question. It's a good one, though. It should go pretty quick, too. Bruce asks, he says, let's say you bought an iMac 6 years ago that came with 10.6 installed. And 6 years later, that's still what's installed. Because of the processor in there, the highest OS you can upgrade to is 10.11, which is El Capitan. But you've never so-called purchased that through the App Store. And he says so-called because he can't use air quotes in email and it doesn't cost anything, or certainly it didn't. He says, so you have no way to download it and install it. How do you proceed? And this is a good question. John, I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, because my default answer is there's technically no way. But the good news is that unlike every other thing you download from the App Store, OS installers are not device or account dependent. They may very well have your account baked into them, but someone can run these installers without your account, or at least that's been my experience with it. So if you have a friend that has one of these installers archived, and word to the wise, archive every, certainly the first, you know, version of each major OS. When you get the installer, copy it off, put it somewhere else. I store them all on my disk station just so that if I find myself in this scenario, I can fix it. But if you have a friend that has done this and you can get a copy of that installer from them, I think you're probably technically violating some license somewhere. I'm no attorney, but my guess is that Apple has better things to do than prosecute people for sharing free software. That's my very unofficial, not legal advice, but I feel pretty good about saying it. It's wrong, but I feel good about saying it nonetheless. But John, I feel like this is one of those questions where you're going to have a great answer.
I do have a great answer.
It's better than mine, isn't it?
I think so, because it solves the problem.
And that's
the
even
answer,
better.
Though I think it, you know, again, license wise, I'm not sure if this is necessarily entirely within the spirit of what I'm about to mention, and okay. I'm going to keep going. Join the developer program for $99.
Oh, right.
Because if you go to developer, and I'll tell you where you go. So you log into your account and then you click on downloads. And then they're going to give you a list of the latest hotness. But you want old and busted. You don't want the new hotness. You want old and busted. Well, if you scroll all the way down, so they show you things that they think you may want. But then if you scroll all the way down, it says see more downloads. Well, I'm going to click and say see more downloads. And then on the left, you're going to get categories. And one of the categories, Dave, is OS X.
Really?
The list,
right.
And if you look at the list here, because the thing is developers may need to test their stuff on an older version of the operating system. So Apple makes them all, well, not all of them available. I'm sorry, I lied. The earliest version that I see on their list here, I believe, is Jaguar. So they do not make available, easily available, I'm sure, if you asked real nice. So why would you even want it? but I think the latest version, yeah, is Jaguar. So you can click, you can download it. Sometimes they give you an App Store code to kind of enable the download. I'm not sure if that's the case with all of these. Like I'm looking right now. So for example.
So John, I think I have a solution that's even better than ours to share. And
yes.
Yeah. And Data for Nothing and Bits for Free in our chat room sent us a link to a knowledge base article called Upgrade to OS X El Capitan. And in that article, it talks about what Macs can run El Capitan, and it says how to get El Capitan. And it says now that macOS Sierra is available, you should upgrade to Sierra instead of El Capitan. However, bullet one says if your Mac doesn't support Sierra or you're using Snow Leopard and would like to run Sierra, you can get El Capitan from the App Store. And the best part is, get El Capitan from the App Store is a link to the App Store. And if you visit that secret little link, you can download OS X El Capitan on your account without doing Dave's illegal method or John's illegal method. And I think yours is far less illegal than mine. But
yeah, I mean, you're paying.
Yeah, you're paying for it. Right. But you can get it for free from the App Store. I am looking at a download OS X El Capitan page right here. And it says if you downloaded El Capitan from the App Store before Sierra became available, you can still reinstall El Capitan from the App Store. And it brings you to a link. So we will put that link in our show notes because that's the best way of all. So thank you so much from Data for Nothing and Bits for Free in the chat room, because that's the That's the trick right there. I didn't even realize that that was possible.
I didn't either.
I know.
It's really nice of them.
It's beautiful.
Huh. Nice handle, too.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Very dire straits.
He saved us from dire straits, John. Oh, that was good, right? And that's a perfect time to bring in the band playing a Go Figure song, not a Dire Straits song, but
of course, timing nonetheless. The other solution is to hoard things. I'm pretty sure I have every installer going, though a caution with that is that there was a point where the certificates, so they include certificates in the installers for security and all that stuff. There was a point where they expired and you had to re-download the installer, several of the installers. So old installers may not work, and that's why.
Right. It's good stuff. We mentioned earlier that we would like you to contact us, but we didn't tell you how feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the best way for you to do that.
You know, I thought I heard you say feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
I did. I said feedback@MacGeekGab.com, and you can also download OS X Snow Leopard, you know, from the App Store. Alex found the link for that, and so we'll put that in the show notes too, because we just can't help ourselves. And those email addresses are right, but if you're a premium subscriber, like we talked about in the beginning of the episode, then you get to use premium@MacGeekGab.com as your email address. And that's a pretty wonderful thing, and we really appreciate it when you do support us as a premium listener. We really appreciate it, like, amazingly so. If you can't or aren't interested, that's okay, too. But if you can and you are interested, MacGeekGab.com/premium. It really does make a difference for John and I here. Any of you are welcome to call or text our voice number, or our phone number, I should say. And that is 224-888-GEEK, which, John, is
4335. And just hope that Hector D. Bird doesn't answer the phone.
Hector's crazy. She now says hola when we come in the house, because I guess we speak too much, not too much, but we speak a lot of Spanish at home. So she says hola to me when I walk in the house now. So very nice of her. You can follow Hector on Twitter at Hector D. Bird, B-Y-R-D. You can follow John on Twitter at John F. Braun. You can follow the show on Twitter at MacGeekGab. You can follow Mac Observer on Twitter at Mac Observer. You can follow me on Twitter at Dave Hamilton. I'd like to thank all of you. I want to thank our premium listeners that helped us out in this show. That was Bruce, Mark, Gary, Roger, and Brian toward the beginning there. I want to thank everybody in the chat room, MacGeekGab.com/stream, for helping us out today. I want to thank you for listening today. Yes, you. You know who you are. No. That person right there. That's the one. Very special human you are. Thank you. I want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. I want to thank our sponsors, of course, Blue Apron at blueapron.com/MGG. I want to thank Fat Cat Software, makers of Power Photos, at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. I want to thank Smile, at smilesoftware.com/MGG. I want to thank the good folks at Otherworld Computing, macsales.com. Of course, Barebones Software at barebones.com, and GoDaddy at godaddy.com. Coupon code MGG saves you and me 30% on everything new you buy there. Have a great week, folks. Have fun. And don't get caught.
Made up.